And then lo and behold, a name that had come up and someone we were looking at was arrested in Salt Lake City. And his name was Ted Bundy. And when the detective from Salt Lake called me and said, "Are you looking for somebody named Ted Bundy? Is somebody, would he be of interest to you?" We felt like for the first time, we were very close to identifying the individual who had abducted and murdered these women.
Today, we are welcoming Kathleen McChesney, and she has held amazing leadership positions in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Catholic Bishops Conference, and the Walt Disney Company. She served in many leadership positions in the FBI, heading its field offices in Chicago, Illinois, Portland, Oregon, and the FBI's International Training Academy before being appointed as the Executive Assistant Director, the Bureau's third highest position. Now, one thing I think that is particularly fascinating about her biography as well is that at just age 24, she was appointed one of the lead detectives in the multi-year national investigation of serial killer Ted Bundy. Later, as an FBI special agent, she conducted and directed investigations into the areas of organized crime, public corruption, and terrorism. So, bad guys, if you are listening or watching this podcast, beware. Kathleen is here to solve all our problems. And I ask you, listeners, what were you doing at age 24, if you're older than that now? Were you hunting for a serial killer? I know I wasn't, so I'm really excited to dig into Kathleen's background. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Ryan.
How has your pandemic been? It's sort of the requisite greeting we have to give each other when we haven't seen each other in a long time.
We've been very lucky in terms of our health. No COVID infections. We are of the opinion that vaccination is a good thing. And while we know a lot of people don't agree with us, we know a lot more people who do. And we feel that it's been a time that we've been able to think about things, to have time to reflect on things. And there's something good about everything. We try to find the good in the pandemic. And that was, you know, reconnecting with people and spending more time reading and hopefully improving ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I like it. You already dipped into controversial waters. That's great. So there's nothing we'll shy away from here. Now, there is actually a bit of history coming up, and we're coming up on an anniversary in the FBI, which was what prompted this little get together. So tell us a little bit about an important anniversary that we're coming up on.
The anniversary that we're coming up upon is the 50th anniversary of women becoming special agents in the FBI. Prior to May the 2nd of 1972, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the FBI's director up until that time, had prohibited women from becoming special agents, carrying guns, enforcing laws, and so forth. And it was only until the time that he died, which was in May of 1972, that the acting director of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, decided that it was more than time to allow women to become FBI special agents. And so two women were selected within the next few weeks at that time and became special agents. And now, you know, in the last 50 years, there have been thousands of women who have been FBI agents and had successful and wonderful careers.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's one of the things as I was researching your extensive bio, which is what tripped me up so much in the intro. It's hard when people, I do try to warn people when they have, we try not to have guests with too many accolades, you know, on there. I'd like to keep your best-selling books to single digits or, you know, the number of academic credentials. It gets too difficult to pronounce. But one thing I noticed that you actually, according to the LA Times, you were one of the first female patrol officers to actually go out on patrol in the state of Washington. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Back in 1972, and yes, I understand that I'm aging myself, but back in 1972, I was one of five women who were working for King County Police and were sworn in as officers. And we all went on patrol, the first in the state of Washington and among the first in the entire country. And so that was a big change, another sea change. That was about the time women started becoming FBI agents as well.
Now, I also read there that one of the initial objections to you being able to go out on patrol was that you didn't weigh enough. So is that a, was that a concern for your safety? And then they actually told you you had to go out and actually gain some weight and then come back to apply for a patrol. Is that correct?
Well, obviously, Ryan, you've been reading the history books on that. And the answer is yes. The answer is that when women initially entered law enforcement in sworn positions, there were certain standards for height and weight. And in my case, I was not tall enough, but that wasn't the issue in terms of my becoming an officer for King County Police. The issue was that although they would accept me at my height, they wouldn't accept me at my weight because it was underweight according to the actuarial standards of the insurance companies. And so hoping to become a police officer, the important thing for me, one of the many important things, was to be able to have insurance. And if I couldn't be insured, I wasn't going to try for the position. So I was allowed to gain the requisite weight so that my height and my weight matched. And so I gained the 7 pounds and the rest is history and extra weight.
Oh, that's funny. I was supposed to say, I'm so glad you did so you could actually go on to have this historic career. Gosh, there's so many things I want to dig into. One of the first things I wanted to ask you is, as I imagine, even though you've been retired from the FBI now for some time, you still have the pulse of it, see it, what's going on. I'm curious, in your opinion, how have the challenges that the FBI has faced over time evolved? And I'd love some thoughts on, you know, kind of now and going on in the future. What are some of the unique challenges that, you know, are largest, our domestic, you know, law enforcement agency for the federal government is going to face in this kind of tech modern world? I'm just curious how it's evolved over time.
Well, Ryan, you ask a really important question. And for students of history, because the FBI is over 100 years old, there have been many challenges over the years that have reflected the culture and the technology and the crime scenarios and patterns within the United States and to some extent, international crime patterns. In the early years of the FBI, of course, the focus was on violent crime and crime that involved some sort of interstate activity. That changed in World War II in particular. During that time, there was a lot of emphasis on foreign counterintelligence. And working with the predecessor agency to the CIA in terms of identifying spies within our midst. And there were, and this is documented in a number of books, FBI operations in foreign countries in conjunction with the war effort. So I encourage your listeners who are interested in history and the FBI to take a look at some of the books regarding FBI's involvement in World War II. It's fascinating. Subsequent to that, the FBI was very much involved in organized crime, investigations of organized crime, recognizing, as J. Edgar Hoover and others did, that organized crime was a growing problem, particularly in the Northeast, but also spread to the Midwest of the United States, and then subsequently to Las Vegas area. And we're talking about traditional organized crime. It was a tremendous challenge to obtain information about the planning of crimes, but as criminals often do, one turned on the other, and the FBI was able to have some very successful cases against organized crime figures. Coupled with that was the increase in technology, the availability of law enforcement to do wiretaps. And that was very helpful in bringing a lot of these organized criminals to justice. In other years, there was a great emphasis on a lot of the criminal activity that occurred in conjunction with protests, and I'm not talking about protests that are legal and safe, but there was a lot of violence, quite a bit of violence on college campuses and so forth. That was a challenge for the FBI to get involved in investigating some of those crimes. Particularly, you had radical groups like the Weather Underground, and the FBI then began doing some domestic undercover operations. Once again, a challenging area because most FBI agents, and they were all male at the time, were really, you know, blue suit sort of people and not really, they didn't really fit in well with some of the radical groups and so forth. But they managed because it was a challenge and because they were talented people. Going forward from that, so many things have changed. The FBI was not involved in investigating narcotics and illegal trafficking of drugs until the late 70s. And then we partnered with local law enforcement and state police, but as well as the Drug Enforcement Administration, to do those kinds of investigations, which are very difficult, as you might expect. And then from that, the FBI found new challenges. The digital world presented enormous challenges for online crime. There were opportunities then for other types of crime, healthcare fraud, and so forth. And I haven't even mentioned terrorism, which has been a priority for the FBI for decades. Probably the focus, the main focus, was when the bombings occurred in New York City, going back into the 1990s, and then, of course, 9/11. From all of that, our additional challenges were in conducting investigations overseas. And the FBI has agents assigned through the embassies in a number of foreign countries, but the real challenge there is the FBI isn't allowed legally to conduct investigations in other countries. So if there's a need to do so, it has to be done at the behest of the foreign government. And so liaison is extremely important. And now there are many crimes that are challenging to the FBI. One of the biggest ones, of course, is in the digital world. How to keep people safe online, how to keep people protected, how to keep their assets protected, how to keep their information protected, and to increase the awareness of people as to the kinds of ways they can become victims.
As far as the terrorism threat, we have Department of Homeland Security, we have FBI. Is that are those sharing the responsibilities? What is sort of the concert of activity that goes on together between all these domestic agencies to keep the average U.S. citizen safe from terrorism? I mean, obviously, there's CIA involved internationally, but I imagine all these agencies have to basically play together, right, and help keep us safe.
You ask a very important question. With the number of federal law enforcement agencies, the number of state agencies, the number of local agencies, as well as tribal agencies, the challenge is to make sure that everyone is working together, that everyone is sharing information, that everyone is, you know, rowing the boat in the same direction. With the kinds of communication tools that are available now and the use of task force, where you might have someone from a police department, someone from the FBI, someone from DEA and Secret Service and local law enforcement working together on a particular crime problem. Those are very effective means for addressing particular crime problems. Working together, you know, it makes good television to have agencies, you know, at loggerheads on a particular issue. And that's not to say that people don't have different approaches, but everybody realizes at the end of the day that if you do not work together, you are going to lose cases. People are going to slip through the cracks. And it's also very dangerous if you don't share information.
All right. So I want to go a little bit here into a little biographical work here. So you are this trailblazing woman in the FBI. You've mentioned in several interviews that being a woman in law enforcement conferred certain advantages that directly goes against sort of the narrative that, the sort of sexist narrative that was kind of probably in place there. And I'd love to talk a little bit about your experience about just, you know, what did you experience? And then what were some of those advantages? There's a great story about a suspect at the Fairmont Hotel in particular that I enjoyed, where you posed as a maid to actually get a suspect to open the door. And he actually believed you, and it wouldn't have worked out so well, and they wouldn't have believed if it was a guy. So you've outlined some cool examples where being a woman in law enforcement has given you some really key advantages.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that most people, even to this day, and it's been, 50 years or more, that women were FBI agents and women have been on patrol in police departments, that there still is not an expectation that a woman is going to come to the door to answer your call for service for police or to be investigating a particular case. I think that in recent years, there has been a lot of entertainment, television programs and movies that do show women in those sorts of roles, but it's still not totally ingrained in our own culture in this country that the person that you would expect to be a law enforcement officer is going to be a woman. That said, the fact of being a woman and not being what is expected gives a woman an advantage in that people aren't expecting her to be listening into a conversation or to be an undercover agent. Women can pose, in any number of roles where they can be disarming. And then another factor there is the fact that people tend to talk more to women than they do to men. They tend to reveal themselves. They will talk about very personal matters with a woman that they might not even know very well. But that same dynamic doesn't generally exist between strangers if someone's talking to a man. And law enforcement investigations are about information. And if you cannot get the information from a witness or a suspect, you might not be able to solve that crime. So I think that women tend to be very, very effective interviewers and interrogators.
When you first started off, because obviously culture, we've made tremendous leaps, but as you point out, still expectations are what they are. When you start off, did you have to work twice as hard, or was that sort of the perception that you had to do everything double to kind of prove yourself since you were fighting that kind of stereotype and expectation? Or was it a little more of a level playing field when you get to that that kind of level of law enforcement?
Ryan, you ask a good question about, do you have to work harder? I don't think it really matters in terms of comparing yourself to another person. You have to work as hard as you can in your career if you intend to have success. You can't lay back on your laurels, have one big case and then, for the rest of your career, just kind of slide by. It doesn't work that way for any kind of success, whether it's for a man or a woman. And by comparing yourself to those around you, are they working harder than me or not as hard as me? That really doesn't move the ball down the field. You have to concentrate on what you can do and do the best and the most that you can do. And the rest, I think, will fall into place.
But for you to move up the ladder, though, did you feel you had to do any of that? Did you feel you had to work harder or to be able to advance as a woman in the FBI?
I don't think working harder is the term that I would use. I think that I would say you have to work better. If you are competing with someone for a leadership position, you need to show that you have qualities that are sought after, that you are competent, that you have integrity, that you have energy, you have the willingness to do the job and to work well with others.
Now, at 24 years old, you were appointed a lead detective on this, on the Ted Bundy investigation, which is mind-blowing to me because at 24, I don't even know what I was doing at 24. So that is a remarkable accomplishment. And actually, for our younger listeners, and I'll admit, I had to actually go back. I mean, everyone's heard of Ted Bundy, but I actually had to go acquaint myself with the details of this case. It was gruesome and horrible, but also fascinating about the escapes, everything. I really had no knowledge of this. So could you give us a brief primer of the kind of the atmosphere at that time when you got appointed to that? What was going on? Was this like, how big a deal was this when you joined the case? You know, what was the big issue and the challenge and just that experience?
Well, I'd have to take you back to the to the mid 70s in Seattle and what was going on in the culture at the time, which was that women were finding some new freedoms. They were able to do things that they hadn't been able to do, both professionally and personally. There was a lot of freedom. And with that came a lot of stupid activity, meaning that people thought everyone was nice and peaceful and it was okay to get in a car with a strange guy because why, who would hurt you? And it was a different sort of a culture. And I think many people, men and women, were very naive about the predators who existed out there. In Seattle, in Washington, in the mid 70s, there came to be a series of unusual cases involving women who went missing, women who were not the type expected to go missing, women who were students, women who had jobs, et cetera. And they were all young women who looked very similar and attractive and were the kind of women who would help a stranger, for example. After several months of the first woman going missing, bodies began to be found in wooded areas, parts of bodies, bones. And though DNA wasn't what it is today in terms of the technology and the science, the women were identified through more traditional means, x-rays and particularly dental records and some pieces of clothing occasionally. As it turned out, there were at least 8 or 9 women who were believed to have been killed during a time period of about 18 months. And so my role was, because I was a sex crimes investigator, I was assigned to work on these cases with part of a team of other detectives who were investigating homicides. And we worked extremely hard to try to find out who the perpetrator was, and the public was tremendous in terms of providing leads to us. We had over 1,000 really viable leads in terms of identifying this individual. It wasn't until the perpetrator actually abducted 2 women on the same day at different times from Lake Sammamish State Park in outside of Seattle, that we had a physical description of the probable perpetrator and a description of a probable vehicle. And this individual was overheard to say that his name was Ted, and he was seen with one of the women outside of a car, which was probably his car, or the car he was using, and it was a brown Volkswagen Bug. So from those limited clues, we were able to find the names of a lot of individuals who fit some of those descriptions. My 2 partners and I, Bob Keppel and Roger Dunn, we worked day and night, really. We had a lot of help at first, but as time went on, police departments with limited resources weren't able to provide us any more assistance. So it was the three of us. And then lo and behold, a name that had come up and someone we were looking at was arrested in Salt Lake City. And his name was Ted Bundy. And when the detective from Salt Lake called me and said, "Are you looking for somebody named Ted Bundy? Is somebody, would he be of interest to you?" We felt like for the first time, we were very close to identifying the individual who had abducted and murdered these women.
Okay, so a couple things here. So it was the three of you, and at the time when these women started disappearing and you had these kind of grisly murders, was it understood that there was probably one suspect who was doing all this, or was there still a lack of clarity about whether all these kind of gruesome activities were all connected? When you started discovering these like body parts in the wilderness and stuff, was it understood this was probably all connected?
We knew after the second or third case that the cases were probably connected. What we didn't know is if it was one person involved, two persons involved, a gang of people involved. It was probably not more than one or two people, because criminals talk. And we figured if it was multiple people that we would probably have heard from one of the participants if it were a group effort. So we were narrowing our search down to one or two people.
Hmm. And then I'm curious about just the psychological burden that you would, like, you know, you're young, so obviously you can work pretty hard and, you know, not burdened with the lower energy that we get as we get older. But was there a sense of urgency? Like, we have to find this because people are, I mean, yeah, what is that? I guess I'm trying to get to, what is that like to work on something like that? And do you allow yourself to rest, or is it a feeling of like, are you able to separate and say, you know, I need to rest to be my best, or I can't spare a moment because there is this madman out there who is hurting people, and we cannot rest until we find him.
Well, there's a certain amount of adrenaline that comes with an investigation like this that's high profile. The pressure from the public and through the media was very high. And it should have been, because this was a community problem. It was a safety issue. And more basic to that, you had family members and friends whose loved ones had gone missing and or were discovered to be murdered. The obligation of law enforcement to do everything that we could to identify the perpetrator was critical. And so that's what drove us literally day and night to be working on this case and doing all that we could to find the clues that would help us to prosecute him.
Wow. And so he was arrested in Salt Lake City. And then I read that he escaped several times or a couple times and into Colorado and was finally arrested again. And then was your role once he was caught in Salt Lake City? Was that when your part ended, or did you continue when he escaped as well? Was there any further involvement after that, or did you stay involved throughout the entire case?
Well, of course, when he escaped twice in Colorado, we were involved to the extent that his family still lived in the Seattle area. So it was incumbent on us to be on the lookout for him and to look in all the logical places, which we did. And then we provided support and assistance in terms of interviews and information that we could provide to the authorities in Colorado and in Utah, but subsequently in Florida, where he was ultimately arrested, convicted of several crimes, and then executed.
Wow. It's a crazy, I was blown away because I hadn't studied up much on it. And since you're my history professor here, where was the Ted Bundy murder and investigation going on in relation to how far after the Zodiac killings was this?
It was, the Bundy case was several years subsequent to that. I can't give you the exact dates, but.
But it seems like there was a string of basically from Northern California and up, you had this sort of scary fear of these mass murderers. I mean, they're relatively close together in some sense, right? I mean, it's an interesting, you talk about the time and the sort of free spirit of the age, and that you had this Zodiac killer, you had Ted Bundy, and it seemed like a very interesting time, I guess, to put it.
Well, that's true. And then there were other serial killers on the West Coast, the I-5 killer, for example, and there's a book about that individual, and then the Golden State killer, and so on. And all of this followed the Manson murders. Now, the Manson murders was a mass murder rather than a serial murder, but at least that's the thinking. But what happened was Charlie Manson and his group, you know, killed not only Sharon Tate and others at Roman Polanski's home, but subsequently, the LaBiancas were murdered on a different day. So Manson was a serial killer in sort of a different way.
So it feels like, and I could be wrong, but it feels like there was this sort of season of these sort of mass cryptic serial killers. And then I'm sure there's these horrible things going on today, but it feels like we don't hear or see sort of this similar situations to what was going on, you know, 40, 50, or 50 years ago. And I'm curious if that's just because technology has, solved some of that, in the sense that some of, I guess this is a way of putting it. Given modern technology we have now, would that have allowed us to capture or solve any of those cases you were on years ago far quicker?
We would absolutely have been able to solve some of the cases much more quickly with the technology that exists. Not only the ubiquitousness of cameras everywhere, the fact that everybody carries one and they're on, you know, major buildings everywhere, but the fact that you have social media, you have a lot of people who try to solve crimes for you. So you're getting information from all kinds of different sources. The GPS technology, the overhearing technology, and the awareness of much of society, particular people who might be in a category of potential victim. And potential victims of serial killers generally are younger people, because they're out and about more. And because serial killers tend to be men rather than women, the victims tend to be women, but are not always the case. In the Wayne Williams case in Atlanta, it was young boys, for example. So there's not, you know, one formula for this, but you're absolutely right that the technology that we have now and the DNA and other forensic capabilities that exist that didn't exist then, they're very important in the change from having, you know, these mini serial killing cases to something else. And or less of them. And of course, now we have more mass murders.
Yeah. Before we get into sort of lessons learned, and because obviously you've compiled and you've put them down in a book, and you've garnered so much, you know, experience from this, I have to ask, just because I'm a millennial and, you know, beholden to my internet algorithms, everyone always wants to know about, and obviously I don't know what tops hunting Ted Bundy is a pretty good start, but in your years of working at the Bureau and just law enforcement, do you have any just either bizarre or, and I hate to use comical, but I imagine there must have been suspects who were brought down and, you know, probably embarrassing ways to themselves, or they've had fitting ends to their stories. But are there any cases that stand out that were just like weirdly bizarre or just fascinating or uniquely challenging? And I know that's almost an impossible question considering how many you must have, you know, worked on over the years, but I'm just curious if there's any top of mind.
There are so many cases that I could talk about. Some are funny.
Okay, there are some funny ones. Okay.
Yeah, some are funny because, you know, there is such a thing as the gang who can't shoot straight. You know, the criminal that leaves his, you know, wallet at the scene of a robbery. And, you know, we've had that. Or they just can't seem to to get it right. There are sad cases as well as funny ones. There are really poignant ones. The cases that really stick out are the ones that where you've had success, say success in rescuing a child who's been kidnapped. And that's, you know, really extremely rewarding to be able to, you know, return a child to their parents. And that's happened a number of times over my career that we've been able to do that. But then there are, you know, other times where, like in the Ted Bundy case, you know, someone's missing, you can't find them. They're a responsible young woman. And, you know, as the days go on, you just know that it may not end well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have that end of the spectrum. But every case is different. Every case is interesting in its own way. You have people, like I said, who can't shoot straight and are not good at being criminals and probably not good at being anything else. And then you have some very, very sophisticated criminals and that can, had they put their intellect to use in another way, would have become, you know, CEOs, created businesses, but they just weren't.
Actually, that's a great question, actually, is have you encountered, were there ever any criminals that you were investigating that you were just, you found yourself either equal parts, you know, sort of, you know, resentment, obviously, for them being criminals or what they're doing, but also somewhat impressed and just like, you know, being like, wow, like this is actually very smart, and sort of lamenting, like you just said, they could have done something else, where you realize you're tracking someone who is clearly very smart or going after someone. And you just think, man, like this could have gone so, your life could have gone a completely different direction.
Many offenders fall into the category of, you know, they have talent and they could have done something else. They could have been good musicians. They could have been good teachers. They could have been good business people. Some of the offenders, particularly those who ran large international drug operations, that is not an easy feat. That is very complicated. If you have a big organization, they have to deal with personnel issues. When people are, you know, the lower level drug dealers are fighting each other, you have to deal with quality control of your product. Even if your product is an illegal product, you have to be careful about things that might be in your drugs that are fatal. And that's a whole other issue and brings down a whole other bunch of heat on the bad guy.
Yeah, it's a quality control, you know, company culture, probably not as big a deal, but, you know, man, that's so, all right. One last question on this too, because I've asked you this before and I'm curious just because I know a lot of our, you know, we've typically done spooky stories on this, but were there to be some cases that seem to have no immediate natural solution or cause to them? Is there any sort of paranormal or supernatural resource within the Bureau where if all other odds, you know, or avenues have been sort of exhausted, is there someone you called? It's like, okay, you know, this is the equivalent of ghost, like we'll check in with some sort of religious expert or whatever, because this thing is just weird. You know, this case is just bizarre.
Well, I have two answers for you on that question. One is no. there isn't a resident psychic for law enforcement. That doesn't mean that in certain cases, particularly involving missing persons, that family or friends might not look to every possible resource, which would include, you know, people who are intuiting, you know, the lost person is at the bottom of a lake or something like that. And that can give people, I understand that can give people hope that they will find a loved one would be found. On the other hand, there are certain types of crime scenes that might suggest that there is a activity involved or a satanic ritual. And in that case, the FBI has many experts in that area, and there are other experts in law enforcement and academia and that can be very helpful in solving those kinds of cases. But it's not as if there is a go-to psychic. No.
Or not. So, yeah, I guess more just like if there's a, you know, is there an understanding that like, hey, you know, it's possible that I guess it depends on the individual FBI agent, but, you know, is there a paradigm where non explainable by physical, you know, attributes, occurrences can happen, and that there is a, you know, you're going to call a priest or something and say, look, this seems to be a very bizarre case. And, you know, is there any supernatural explanation for this? I know that sounds bizarre to say, but I'm just, you know, I think because in the movies, I always portray FBI and the Vatican working together, you know, to investigate certain like supernatural crimes, et cetera. And I'm just curious if there's been, you know, something weird enough where you're like, you know, we need to call agents and we need a priest for this one.
There are times when you would call a religious expert, but it depends on the crime scene and the situation. And you really have to, you know, evaluate that, because that can lead you, the crime scene and the clues can lead you to the identity of the individuals involved, as well as, you know, to what happened when. So there's a possibility for that, but this isn't it's not part of a normal investigation. Most investigations don't really require that or have those kinds of clues.
Okay. All right. So Ghostbusters is not a real thing at the FBI for now. We did have Ernie Hudson on from Ghostbusters. So he will be, I'm sure, saddened to know that the FBI doesn't have a division for this, but I'll break the news to him. As we sort of near the end here, I'm curious, you wrote these down in your book, Pick Up Your Own Brass, but I'm curious, what are some of the most important just lessons that you would, one way to frame this is, you would plead with your younger self to heed? I love asking people to reflect back and say, I wish I could go back and tell myself in my 20s this, et cetera. And then other just lessons that you feel are just so vital for the next generation to learn as they go about their lives. You obviously have collected quite a few. So you chased Ted Bundy around. You must have picked up something, you know.
Oh, there are so many lessons. And, you know, the lessons don't end when you are in your 20s or your 30s. The lessons that you learn in your work and in your life just go on, you know, as long as you live, I believe. But some of the things that we learned, as you mentioned in the book that Bill Gavin and I wrote about leadership in the FBI, Pick Up Your Own Brass. The whole premise of that was that when you are at the range, if you're in the military or law enforcement, you will identify with going to the range and doing your qualifications. And when you're shooting, brass comes out of your, is ejected from your weapon. And it's very important to be disciplined at the range. And when you get done shooting, you pick up all your brass, because you don't want to leave a mess for anyone else. And so Pick Up Your Own Brass is something that you do as a responsible person, responsible law enforcement person. And as a leader, you want to be picking up your own brass. You don't want people to think that because you're the leader, you're entitled, because you're not. The only thing you're, if there's an entitlement to being a leader, it's to have the privilege of serving other people and to helping them do their jobs better and providing the kinds of support that they need to do those jobs. And picking up your own brass, a leader will always pick up their own brass, doesn't expect other people to do that for them, but they will pick up somebody else's brass as well, meaning identifying when somebody else, you know, has a need that you can help with. It all boils down to interpersonal relationships. Yeah, particularly in the law enforcement field. If you can't get along with people, if you don't really like working with people, other people, strangers, as well as your teammates, you're probably not going to like law enforcement. Lessons that I've learned, obviously, you know, do something that you love, that you believe in, keep your integrity intact. Don't compromise on things that you do. And also, recognizing that everything you do in an organization reflects on everybody else. So it's a big responsibility when you're in public service to always be thinking about doing the right thing. So were those lessons I wish I'd learned? Yes, of course. And I wish, I'd worked harder when I was younger and spent more time, learning my craft. But it all worked out pretty well.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen. And your career is an inspiration, and we're all better off and safer for you being on the job. So I appreciate that. Is there anything you'd like to plug or mention before we sign off, or throw some shade at Jim? Either one of those is fine.
Well, thank you for asking. I would say that the FBI, a wonderful place to work. I would do it all over again, 25 years again. Or in law enforcement career, because you do have the opportunity to work with people and to do, I think, some good things for safety and security of our nation and our local communities. And law enforcement across the country and the FBI is hiring men and women, and it's a great career. And so I'd encourage anybody that's listening who might have an interest to check out the appropriate websites.
Awesome. Go out there, join the FBI, get some cool stories of your own. I can edit this out later if it's not relevant, but I'm curious, jog my memory, with everything that went down with Director Comey and everything, do you view any sort of politicization of the FBI as being sort of just temporary and that all kind of will fade off? Or do you think there were some... Because I remember that being a very interesting question for a lot of people about what is the role there at the FBI, and then what should or shouldn't he have done. But this idea that the FBI is involved in politics—that's obviously not a new thing, right? I mean, because J. Edgar Hoover, had some involvement in politics as well. So I'm curious, any thoughts you have just on the idea of the FBI and it being politicized?
The FBI should not be politicized. And I think that if you were to talk with the majority of FBI agents, they would very clearly recognize and articulate that. That said, there are times when politics does influence the FBI activities. The biggest example is probably within the budget process, because the FBI doesn't exist without federal dollars, and the federal dollars are meted out through the budget process. And the legislature, the U.S. Congress, has a great deal to say about, what pools of money go to which agencies. And the appointment of an FBI director for 10 years, as was codified some years ago after J. Edgar Hoover died, is an important one. And the thinking until recently was that, unless there was something really horrible that happened, 10 years would be the tenure of FBI directors, or whenever they chose to leave. Some chose to leave sooner. So it's really important that FBI agents and those people seeking FBI roles understand that integrity is key. And that regardless of your personal opinions, and FBI agents are like everybody else, they have personal opinions about what's going on in the world. The mission of the organization is to protect citizens and to investigate crimes, federal crimes. So keeping focused on the mission and maintaining personal and professional integrity is paramount.
Amen. Amen to that. Kathleen, thank you so much for camping with us, though. I know this bears no resemblance to camping, given that we're both inside right now and we can't be by our campfire. But as soon as gas prices return to something reasonable, we'll get our bus up there and we'll visit you.
Yeah, we'd enjoy that.
folks, thank you for camping. Get out there, help serve your country and law enforcement if you can. Go to the FBI or turn yourself in. If you're a brilliant criminal, turn yourself in and use your talents otherwise, is what Kathleen says. So
that's right. We'll find you.
That's what she will find you. So thanks for listening, everybody.